Museum of the Moving Image welcomes you to the Pinewood Dialogues Online, an archive of conversations with innovative creative figures in film, television, and digital media. Visit Museum of the Moving Image in New York City or online at www.movingimage.us.
Please welcome Leslie Manville, Timothy Spall, and Mike Lee. Thanks so much for being with us. One thing that really struck me about this movie is the physical beauty. I just wondered if you could talk about that first before we get into the performance and the writing. What are some of your ideas in terms of the way you use space?
Well, it's hard to talk about that as a kind of abstract thing. Mm-hmm. This, of course, is a film about people, but it is a film about place as well. And I mean, certainly speaking personally, I am endlessly, though I'm primarily motivated to make films about people and relationships and love and, you know, feelings, and which is what this film's about. That element, which is also about place, and the poetry of place and the spirit of place, is very much something that informs this film. Making films, as everybody here knows, is a very practical business. I mean, you know, writing a novel is in itself, I guess, a practical process. You've got to actually write the novel. And what we try and do with this kind of film is to make movies with the same kind of organic freedom that other people write novels. And but it is finally about being out in places with characters in, you know, and looking at them. And in some way, which is hard to explain, when we made this film, it was curiously blessed with a sort of extraordinary run of, well, I suppose at the lowest you could call good luck. So, for example, we evolved the characters and the notions for this film over when we actually rehearsed for some 6 months before we started to shoot anything. And during the earlier part of that, I sort of decided that, yes, it would all take place on this public housing estate. And when I said that to the design team, they were horrified, because famously, these kind of places where there are hundreds of people all living in apartments are very difficult to shoot in. It upsets people's lives, and people are not necessarily very friendly when you want to go and film and so forth. But I was insistent, and we were developing the film in the district of Greenwich in London. And I said, in an ideal world, we'd find an estate in Greenwich. And they said, well, that's a very tall order, you know, very unlikely. And a couple of weeks later, the location scout, as you call them here, came and said, amazing, we found this housing estate right in the middle of Greenwich, and the great thing about it is it's empty. Everybody's been moved out, and we can do a deal with them, and it's completely available. And the designer and I went to see Eve Stewart. We went to see it, and of course it could have been available and empty and horrible and not the least bit inspiring, but in fact it had an extraordinary poetry about it in itself. So, as I say, obviously, it is all about the characters and the relationships, but to be able to put them in this environment and to get kind of real inspiration back from what you could see, that's the buzz of filmmaking.
Now, you talked about a six-month rehearsal process, which is, of course, extraordinary for film, certainly is here. How is the writing process separate from the rehearsal process for you?
In what we do, the important thing is that we arrive at a film. Mm-hmm. And that we eventually arrive at something which is very precise. Yes. But there isn't a separate writing process. I mean, when we finally, having created the characters and the relationships and the whole world of, at the time of shooting, when we actually pin down moment for moment exactly what happens down to the last word and the last moment, that is done through rehearsal. It's written through rehearsal. I don't go away and write something I couldn't, because these guys contribute something which is absolutely organic and three-dimensional.
What is the preparation process? Is it, you know, the sort of idea of method acting is that you go and, you know, you would like drive a cab for 6 months, but to get into character. How do you find your character?
Method acting, I've never read about it, but I presume it's just about knowing where your character has come from and where they might be going to, or invariably not where they're going to, because like most human beings, they don't know where they're going to. They may have various appointments, but on the whole, they don't know what destiny is. So, I mean, but I assume that it's the entire exercise of the rehearsal is about creating a whole sort of parallel universe to a certain degree of information and fact about these people that you're going to eventually depict in a movie. And it's more to do with preparation, isn't it, than it is to do with rehearsing what you're going to end up doing. It's all about creating an entire lagoon, a huge lagoon of information that eventually becomes part of the psyche and the physicality of the characters, and just the mere day-to-day information, shared information often about, you know, what makes these people's lives. So, you know, so it probably is method, but I mean, most people who talk about method haven't read Stanislavski. Mm-hmm. I think it just means it looks real when they watch it. That's
just to take one scene as an example. I mean, the scene when you say that she doesn't love you, you know, that very powerful scene. And it is played very precise. It certainly doesn't feel improvised. And every line of dialogue seems very...
Well, it isn't improvised.
But could you talk about how that scene evolved, for example, how you worked on that?
Well, the simple fact is that everything you see on screen is not improvised. It's structured and it's shot and it's rehearsed exactly the same way as any other scene is made in a film. But it's just the tip of the iceberg of the preparation you've made, as it were. I mean... Because you know these characters inside out, psychologically, more than you know yourself, because you've created them and you haven't created yourself to a certain degree, you know through the process of rehearsal and preparation, you know where they stand. You know where they are at the moment where they are. You never know what's going to become of them. Mm-hmm. So by the time that my character, Phil, expressed his despair, which is what he's carrying with him right from the beginning of the movie, although he doesn't understand it until the French lady says to him, "Do you love your wife?" When we have actually eventually did the improvised scene that those scenes were based on, my character was desperate. Not me, my character was desperate to express himself. It was so needed to be said, and it wasn't in any sense planned, and it wasn't in any sense contrived. It happened to come out in an improvisation that I think, Leslie, I don't, you can say, I don't know what you say from Penny's point of view.
Well, I mean, just to sort of add to that, I've found that a lot of the press that we've been doing lately, a lot of people have said to me, you know, why didn't Penny stand up to her son, and why did she never say to Phil, get your act together or whatever. But the process is not about sitting down and making sort of decisions like, oh, let's make her like this, mm-hmm. or why doesn't she say that? It does evolve in quite a sort of pure way. And when people have said to me, why doesn't she stand up to them, it's quite a hard question to answer, because the thing is, she just doesn't. And she just doesn't because... Of the girl that we created, and the teenager that we created, and then the woman that we created. You know, she was all of those things as a person always, and so when the film begins and picks her up as a, you know, late 30s, whatever she is, old woman, she is the product of everything that she was, which is why the process, the build-up to the filming works, because it's about creating a three-dimensional character that then takes care of itself, really. You don't ever have to think how will she react in this situation, because you just put the characters in the situation and it happens. And at the end of the film, you know, you give these two people who have stopped communicating with each other for so many years, and you give them an event like their son having a heart attack, and it brings out of them both the ability to finally say what they feel.
Yeah, painful, an awful ability to actually confront. Because like most people, these characters don't have any control. They don't have any particularly self-authorship about what they're going to do. They're the sum total of their despair, and they're the sum total of their frustrations. And so when they eventually do it, because of the process, it feels like it's actually real for the character, not for you. You don't use yourself, you use the character's predicament, because there's a very precise ring fence around you and your character. So as I say, because the process only allows you to know where you are precisely at that given time, in situ, you can't predict what's going to become of you.
So when you're filming that, you don't know that the ending, for example, is going to be really a very optimistic ending.
No, you only know what your character knows. Yeah. Like life.
Now, you've said that filmmakers should aspire to the condition of the documentary filmmaker, not that movies should look like documentaries, but that, could you elaborate on that?
If you make a documentary, I mean, the subject matter exists whether you film it or not. I say, and I only say that because it's the case with any number of dramatic fictional films, feature film, that it's kind of fake and that it only exists in a sort of implausible two-dimensional way just in front of the camera. There's no sense that it exists, that it would exist whether you film it or not. So I said that, which is not to be taken too literally, as an expression of that aspiration in making these kind of films, to create a world in front of the camera where you really do feel it's living and it isn't just a kind of artifice that only exists at the moment when the camera turns over.
Food is so important in this film, how people eat, what they eat. And actually, if any of you could just sort of talk about how this evolved, this sort of...
Well, I would simply say, not to dwell on it, that it's simply part of of what their lives is about, really. And I don't think I would want for us to dwell in any depth on it as a kind of basis for anybody's thesis, really.
How long are you actually shooting, like once you do start the shooting?
12 weeks.
Your character, his eyes kept darting around all over the place, and was always looking aside. Is that somebody that you've encountered, or?
I don't know. I mean, characters tend to be based on somebody or various people you may have known, but they quickly become their own personalities. It's hard to speak objectively. One can only do it after the event. But looking back on it, one of the aspects of his characters was that he was totally aspirational and completely completely non. He wasn't interested in being successful in the first place. Also, he was very quite an intelligent man with very little education, but is very perspicacious in a sense about people, very aware of people around him, very aware of his situation. But having said all these things, absolutely no ambition, he completely and utterly and eminently ignorable as far as the rest of humanity is concerned. I mean, most of the time people react to the back of his head. They don't see him. They just see this greasy hair, and they put what they want onto him. So they don't ever really connect with him. The one person who does is the sophisticated French antique dealer who he encounters. No one else really, as far as his clientele, for want of a better word, really. So, but what he is he's bright, aware of what's going on, but he's in a state of great melancholy because of what's bugging him about his life, which he doesn't really become aware of until the French lady asks him directly whether he loves his wife or not. And so I think that's what it is. He's like a lot of people you encounter in mundane jobs. They're eminently ignorable, but they're actually just as humane, human, and just as intelligent as some of the great, intellects who just haven't had the opportunity.
Because what we do is doesn't spend time written on a page. It is completely three-dimensional and organic. I mean, what we do at great length, over a long period, is to work at not just the idea of the character, or the condition of their lives, which is the kind of thing Tim's been talking about, but the way that they each manifestly exist. In other words, we're simply dealing in the physical, psychological, emotional, palpable language. Some people talk about body language. It's not in my vocabulary, but that's what people talk about. And that we all of us, I mean, everybody in this room has a whole range of physical manifestations that are all to do with our idea of ourselves and our idea of how other people see us and our cultural, educational, class, aspirational, all kinds of stuff that motivate how we actually are physically and how we behave and all that stuff. And that's equally important, and that's the sort of stuff that is there in Phil and which your question is about.
And Leslie, how did you find, what was the key for you to finding Penny's behavior? You know, how did you find her character?
It's very difficult to talk about it in that way because as I said earlier, it's not about sitting down and making conscious decisions. And so nothing is kind of labeled onto a character that you think, oh, let's make her like this because that'll make her interesting.
Yeah.
You know, it's really much more subtle than that. It does happen over a long period of time. And as I said, it really starts with the child that you get on the go, and then the child is what they are, and then they become older and older and they develop, and it happens in that way. It's
if I may say so, the question you ask is in a way in the language of what normally happens when people work on characters, mm-hmm. conventionally, mm-hmm. in a script. You say, well, you know, how do we, what should we do to make, what are the keys? What can we hang on to make this character work, to come alive? What can we breathe into this thing that's on the page?
Yeah.
So, you know, and it's that sort of language. I mean, over and above all the kind of, you know, sort of lofty things that we're saying, the main thing about this is we make these people up. You know, we actually invent these characters. I mean, we actually invent this whole world, and it's all about that, really. And we don't.
I mean, when you're working on more conventional scripts, obviously you are thinking in that way. You know, mm-hmm. you've got a script and you've got a set of events that will happen and things that happen to your character, and then you have to try and find a way as an actor that justifies those things mm-hmm. happening. But we're not working in that way. You're coming at it from a different angle, so the same set of questions don't really apply.
Mm-hmm. The rehearsal process versus the production process. If you're rehearsing for 6 months, discovering story, and then shooting for another 3 months, how does one affect the other, and have you already discovered the story by the end of the rehearsal process before you start shooting?
No, absolutely not. And in fact, it's a very good question, a very useful one. The truth of the matter is that we don't in any way during the preliminary 6 months resolve the whole thing. We absolutely don't do that. In fact, what we do when we go out to shoot the film, we go out and make a film up. And we go through the whole, the film evolves and grows as we shoot it. And what we do for the 6 months prior to that is to prepare ourselves for that process. Because what underlies your question is the fact that it doesn't matter what the hell you do before you get to shoot. What matters is what happens when you shoot, because it's a film. And all the other stuff is merely preparatory. And in fact, not only is it all about actors and acting and characters and relationships and all of that and themes and that side of things, the definition of the material as we film it is equally a matter of design and cinematography and shots and sound and all of those things, because it's a film. When we're shooting these films, you know, technicians and people say, it's extraordinary. I mean, how do they just show up and they seem to, why are the actors so relaxed, and how is it they always know the lines, and why are they so solid in what they're doing, and why are there no, why don't the actors on this film throw terrible tantrums like they do in all other films? Why is it that everybody gets on so well? Why is it so peaceful and harmonious? And why is it so creative? And suddenly people show up and there's no scene, and an hour later there's a whole scene there. And so because we prepare it, and when you see Penny and Phil at the end of the film, as you just have, they finally pull together
and suddenly some light comes on and you see their relation, you suddenly understand what their relationship once was, and they actually, you know, are rediscovering something that once existed. He says, you know, you used to make me laugh, and there's a moment. What you are actually seeing physically is something that we actually experienced in the long journey of the rehearsals, because the rehearsals are not rehearsals in that preparatory period. They are living through the lives of the characters. So there was a time, way back at the beginning of those 6 months, when these characters came together as very young people and had this very positive relationship. And then we lived through the years and years and years and the accumulation of the layers and layers of encrustations of all the things that finally get in the way between them. And that was an actuality. So in answer to your question, what we've done in that preparatory period isn't actually bother with rehearsing a film or fixing up the story. It's preparing ourselves to then go and make up the film, working with the crew and developing it as we go along.
But on the day of the shoot then, you show up, or whenever you show up in the morning, what do you know about what's going to happen?
What you've just seen is a film where every moment was very precisely rehearsed during the course of the shoot. You know, some days are rehearsal days and some days are filming days.
And it seems to me that something should have come out between them before this lady. You really didn't need this lady or the son to even get sick, realistically speaking, because they had it within themselves beforehand, and you knew that.
Well, if I may say so, I mean, that is a romantic...
I'm sorry?
A romantic and certainly optimistic view of it. I mean, if we were to agree on that, then we are merely saying that in an ideal world, that's the situation. Look, this film is a dramatic, metaphorical film. It is not a documentary. I'm serious. And it is, I mean, of course, you see, as in any heightened and distilled dramatic piece of cinema, or indeed theatre, you see events that are arranged in a, what in this case I would suggest is a kind of classical way, in order to get to the core of the issues. Now, apart from the fact that I think it is in real life terms to millions of people all around the planet, it is entirely plausible that relationships lie dormant and buried, and you know, communication breaks down, and it takes a crisis or something to precipitate something to break that, which is what the film is actually about. The main thing is that happens because the film is also about, on another level, about fate and about the fact that sometimes it's curious how things do happen together at the same time. You can decode this film in lots of different ways. I mean, you know, and if you want to talk about it in Greek classical terms, you know, film is on a journey and he meets a messenger who, tests him and then gives him a message. And at this precise moment, something is happening of a calamitous nature. You know, from a thematic point of view, it's for you to take away from the film the differences that you discern between those two couples. I mean, you have to look at them as all part of a whole. You could say, why is Maureen so positive and so able to cope when she, in some ways, has got less than anybody else, really? But you have to look at these characters in relation to each other as a thematic collective, if you like, in order to take away from the film conclusions about the nature of how we live.
And Phil seems quite open to that. I mean, it's set up that he knows it. Talks about how you don't know what's going to happen every day when you wake up.
Well, yeah, I mean, the thing is about Phil is... he's an armchair philosopher to a certain degree. You know, this is what Mike's films say often, you know, that this is, which is an indirect answer to that question, is that this is the way people are, not how you want them to be. And Phil's predicament is that although he's a naturally intelligent somewhat lazy man. Every time he gets anywhere close to realizing what his problem is, it compounds his situation. It doesn't make him proactive and say, I'm an overweight, unproductive man that kind of understands that his wife is pissed off of him because he's not taking the bull by the horns and helping the situation by being proactive. What it does is it makes him, his despair compounds his condition. So when he gets more despairing, he gets lazier. Instead of when he gets more despairing, he wakes up and all of a sudden becomes like somebody in another film that would go, hey, I'm a boring fat man that should wake up. And what happens, like it does in life, to a lot of people, they don't have that control. They don't have an objective view of their own lives. They don't have group therapy.
Or choices.
They don't do that. They may be intelligent, but they are the victims of their own predicament. He can't, you know, he's not going to be helped by anybody. This family is not going to be all of a sudden corralled into family therapy. They live where they do, and they're pretty low on the rung of on the food chain of.
Saying that it's like divine intervention that they were saved, and I'm trying to say that that's not really the case. That you set it up. That
I think it's entirely your prerogative to think that, but I think in a way, with all due respect, that's more to do with your view of life and the world. You know, what I'm inviting you to do through the film is to look at the way, as Tim says, people are in a less than ideal world.
That Phil has this going on inside of him. And when the French woman raises that question, he's listening to that question because he has that question within himself. And it has a meaning and a resonance, obviously. If he weren't ready for it, he wouldn't hear it.
I mean, I think that really is a very useful key to the answer to the previous question, because neither the heart attack nor the chance conversation with the French passenger are in any real way absolute cataclysmic causes of change. They simply exacerbate things that were already there. I mean, that obviously, and in that sense, of course, that's what it's about.
You produce, obviously, a great deal of emotion in your audience and the viewer. I wonder how your experience of that emotion is different from ours. Obviously, it's many months longer.
When I watch the film, I get very emotionally tied up with it. Other characters as well as my own. And that's peculiar. I find that rather peculiar that I feel moved by Penny, and I suppose it's partly because she does feel like somebody who's sitting next to me as opposed to me. So I do get very wound up in it, watching it sort of objectively. Doing it is something else, and that for me anyway is in a way like doing anything else that is emotionally demanding. It, at the end of the day, it requires a technique to get you through doing stuff like that. I mean, we know the characters and we know what they're doing and we absolutely know how they're going to react and how they're going to be, but the process of filming is the same with Mike as it is really to an observer. Would be pretty much the same on any job that you do, any filming job that you do once you get to that point. You just have to find the way that gets you through a day where you've got to do a lot of emotional stuff. But it's not a kind of depressing experience where we're all walking around, you know, being grim and not speaking to each other all day. You get very used to the whole thing of going into character and coming out of character, and the more in touch with your character you are, and by the time you get to filming you're very in touch with your character, you can go in and out of character fairly easily without kind of great build up or preparation. So you do a scene like that, and then, you know, we'll stop and we'll have a laugh and have a cup of tea and talk about something else, and then go back into it and do it again.
There is this very, very strong definition between yourself and the character. It's absolutely precise. You put your character on and you take it off like a suit. So, okay, so you still have to get in touch with various things inside yourself to make characters feel upset, but on the whole, there's you and there's the character, and you say, you know, you put it on and you take it off, and it's very helpful.
But I would say, at the most basic and straightforward level, there is nothing fake about any of this. The depth of emotion and the sheer power and resonance of all of that absolutely happened when we shot it, and we were absolutely committed to it. And in fact, I mean, notwithstanding, I mean, what Tim and Leslie have just talked about is about the necessary things that actors have to do to cope with doing this stuff. But I mean, you know, they, in a way, they inadvertently demean themselves in terms of their achievement, because the fact is, at the most emotional scenes of this, they really were in it. And of course, for me, what's very important and always very useful is the way that the crew relate to what's going on. And when we're shooting, particularly the really kind of traumatic stuff, I mean, the crew is absolutely there, and the atmosphere, you can cut it with a knife. And I mean, the bottom line is quite simple, that, you know, if we don't actually experience it when we're making the film, how the hell can we ever expect you to? And the tragedy is that you sit and watch any number of movies where they didn't really experience it, and they still expect you to, and what you're looking at is bullshit. With this film, I mean, at the risk of being a little bit smug about it, the emotions were there for real, and we absolutely, you know, felt it. I mean, speaking just for myself, if I'm not seriously moved to the depths of my emotions when I'm working on this material, then I think it's not working, and I don't want to put it in front of an audience.
The question is, when you go to other quote-unquote normal work in which you show up and you look over and say, okay, I'm going to do it, I mean, how do you make that transition?
The difference between working with Mike and a conventional film, as you probably know, is the difference between 6 months rehearsal and 6 minutes, you know, which means that you have to do a lot more. What you realise, I think, every time I'm reminded, I work with Mike, and I've worked with Mike, as Leslie has, for 6 times over 21 years, is that you really have to do your homework. You do very little homework with Mike, because it's all there all the time, and it's shared and it's collaborative.
So, yeah, I mean, there's no getting away from it. It's the general state in England is, I'm sure, is the same here. There's no rehearsals, and you just have to get on with it. And there's absolutely nothing you can do about that. And sometimes even if you know, in England, if you have a few days rehearsal, you feel lucky. But you could have a few days rehearsal with somebody who doesn't even know what to do, with a director who doesn't even know how to help you in those few days. But I mean, it's unquestionably what I take from my work with Mike is the ability to kind of pray-see the whole process and do it by myself, and, you know, get the character together at home, and then go to work and hope that you get a little bit of something that helps you. And because I don't like doing it on my own. I mean, I like working with. I can come up with a character, and I can, you know, I can do the acting, but I don't know if it's in the right mould. I don't know if I'm off on the wrong tangent. You know, I need a third eye telling me what's right and wrong. So I don't enjoy it when I think what happens a lot is that, you know, people get you in because they know who you are, and they think they like your work, and they sort of think, oh, well, let's get Tim or Leslie, because they'll turn up and they'll come up with something interesting.
Well, exactly. A director said that to me once. I said, what are you expecting of? He said, oh, you'll be all right, because you've done all them films with Mike, haven't you?
And also, I think people expect you, when they know that you've worked with Mike, they A, expect you to come up with something brilliant, you know, by yourself. And they also think that if a scene doesn't work in a scripted piece, that that you can just start improvising it, not understanding that, you know, it's one thing to improvise in the way that we do, which is very carefully and, you know, and not an immediate thing that you do either. And it's quite a different thing to just turn up on a set and start improvising when there's no shared information and you don't know what the game is and nobody knows what the other character's about. And it's all just to try and make a scene work that doesn't work on paper. And I get really pissed off about that because you think, well, you've got a script, let's do the script. And if the script doesn't work, give it back to the script writer. But don't get us in to try and sort it out, you know.
I just suddenly realised, I never thought of this, but somewhere along the line I'm missing a trick. I could be making some money out of
it. You ever get in a case where you are kind of trying to bully or cajole the film in a certain direction and the actors are kind of resisting you?
No, I mean it's an interesting way to put it, but it's nothing to do with what it's about, because I'm a writer and a director. I find it impossible to draw any distinction between those. For me, it's one welded, homogenous job. If anything is going on that doesn't work for the actors, in the sense that they feel it's inorganic or an imposition or wrong, then it's not good enough to be in the film. What doesn't happen is a kind of free for all. A great deal of what goes into the film is organic and grows out of things that happen out of the characters. But my, as I would see it, the art of my input, if you like to put it in those terms, is to stimulate things so that they grow in an organic way. I mean, it's not, there's no tension in that sense. I mean, obviously, you know, there's no question that the decision to have a heart attack, it's a deus ex machina decision on my part, but that is the function of a dramatist. Similarly, the putting together of all the characters, even the putting together of these characters, is, you know, my decision somewhere along the line. I mean, I put them together, but, you know, then the thing is to draw from, to use and to develop together what happens out of that. But that is in the nature of storytelling. In other words, what I'm saying is, it's not a kind of, you know, some kind of impurity or some kind of tension. It is in the nature of what we're doing, which is to make up stories and make up stories that are interesting. It is what it is. You know, you plant things and water them, and as long as you choose the right seeds and plant them in the right place and arrange them in the right configuration, and then you nurture them and, you know, tend them, then they grow into a garden that makes its own kind of sense.
A big chunk of what Mike's doing is observing what we're doing, observing the people that we're becoming and the emotional tensions and feelings that are developing between the characters. So it's not a case of him suddenly... I see where you're coming from and the question you're asking, but it's not like him suddenly throwing in something that's going to make us all think, oh my God, he's doing that for an effect because he wants the film to go in this territory. You know, it is all, as he says, it's born out of what he observes that we're doing. I mean, we do improvisations that last an awful long time, you know, hours, where there is no pressure on us ever. In fact, we are particularly informed never to try and make an improvisation interesting. You know, that is not the name of the game at all. So we'll do improvisations that last hours, where this family just sit and eat, watch the telly most of the time, go to the loo, read a book, do the crossword. You know, nothing happens in inverted commas. But through all of that, you get to see what these people feel about each other. And that's what Mike's observing. So a huge amount of his time, once we're up and running with the characters, is to observe emotionally what's going on between them, so that then when he does feed in something, which for all the reasons that he says he has to, because at the end of the day he's the dramatist, it's not like having something alien thrown in. It's all right.
It always feels organic, doesn't it? It always feels, it never feels like an imposition. I mean, you know, Mike's objective view is supreme, and his mixture of gardening and chemistry and alchemy that he's working on all the time. You never feel in any sense that you're being forced into anything. I've often said that it's a real mixture of being, from an acting point of view, incredibly subjectively aware of what your character's condition is, but as much as you're enlightened by your character, you're totally in the dark about where it's going. That's, and then you, as an actor, you just trust that Mike's, what he's doing is engendering everything, but his overview will lead you into this area, and you go, not willingly, or not, you don't even have to go willingly, you're going like you are a human being who this series of events eventually takes you. So that's
Are there other directors who have been working in the style you're talking about?
I'm not aware of anybody who's worked in this style. I mean, there are people who have attempted to, people who have done what they call using this technique, but I don't know what that means, really. It doesn't mean anything much. There's a Danish film kicking around, but apparently, I haven't seen it, and apparently it's very good, but its director claims to use my technique. I don't know what it means, that, because it's like saying that, you know, you use Van Gogh's technique to paint pictures from the daffodil, but that doesn't mean anything as far as I'm aware. I don't know what Van Gogh's technique was, really. But I know that if you get a flat puncture, there's a technique for changing the wheel on your car, but that's as far as I understand it. So far as in any real sense, I don't think, but then I don't see why anybody should do what I do, because it's totally personal and utterly idiosyncratic and deeply eccentric.
What do you start with? You talked about this 9-month process of rehearsal and shooting. What is the initial impulse?
For me, it comes out of feelings and just a general ongoing sense of, I mean, there are ongoing preoccupations, but all art is a synthesis of improvisation and order. All artists improvise and then put order on it. You have, you know, there's a lot of serendipity is involved in whatever you do. Part of the creative process is to meet a whole load of actors. I mean, I know hundreds of actors in England, but it's always worth meeting new ones, particularly young ones. And when I was auditioning for this particular film, having already agreed with Tim and Leslie that they should take part, I saw a lot of young actors, and amongst these young actors were two actors, an actor and an actress, who you wouldn't have to be particularly clairvoyant. In fact, you'd have to be something other than, you'd have to be actually blind or dead not to spot that they were both quite fat and that they could play brother and sister. And they could possibly be the children of this particular, of a couple played by these actors, conceivably. And that, you know, I thought, well, that's a good idea, and they both turned out to be very good young actors, Alison Garland and James Corden, and I got them in and they became part of the thing. Now, once having made that decision, that then, you know, resonates back to ideas about, you know, which I've dealt with before, which are ongoing preoccupations about, you know, living and food and heart conditions and various other things, but, you know, and surviving and the frustration and stuff, which is part, you know, is one of the, those are strands that are going on in the film. There's a whole collection of, as there is for any sort of artist, with of ideas and feelings, and, you know, it's a film about love, and that were things that I wanted to kind of try and deal with in that area, and discover what the film is by the process of making it, and that carries on right through to the editing, you finally, because you, and that is how people make art. Unfortunately, it's in the nature of commercial Hollywood cinema, but that doesn't happen very much, because great committees of people kill any sort of investigation stone dead by, you know, trying to formalize everything that happens in a movie.
And do you feel optimistic about the conditions now in England to make films? I mean, we've seen this has been such a strong year.
It comes and goes, and there's some good films being made and quite a lot of bad films being made, but at least films are being made in the UK.
when I see these films, I see a great deal of abstraction in the acting, very heightened, almost artificial acting styles, and that's a big part of the impact of the film. I'm always a little surprised that these films are discussed in terms of documentary acting realism.
I couldn't agree more. Nothing is more ridiculous than when a film like this is discussed in terms of naturalism and documentary. I think it's utter nonsense. This obviously is a very heightened and distilled kind of cinema. Of course, what's important is that at any given moment, this is about realism, not naturalism. You absolutely, you know, relate to these characters in a completely total way in the moment, because they are, they read as being absolutely real, because they are reflections and depictions of real people as people are. But the actual dynamics and chemistry of what is going on is undoubtedly extremely heightened and, as I say, distilled, and not at all about naturalism. So you're absolutely right, if I understand you correctly.
Okay, well, I really can't thank you enough for sharing this great evening with us, so thanks for being here.
Thank you for listening. The Pinewood Dialogues at Museum of the Moving Image are made possible by generous support from the Pannonia Foundation. To learn more about the museum, visit www.movingimage.us.